When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Tamper with you.
Welcome to tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
What do you do, baby?
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Was it right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
Trial you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Hey, we don't have to tamper with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. I'm Sam Amick, NBA national writer at The Athletic, here with my guy, Fred Katz. Fred, I'm on your coast, man. I came to join you kind of, sort of, as I sit in my Boston hotel heading into Game 3 of the NBA Finals. You might sense a slight bit of, you know, West Coast sleep deprivation fatigue that I'm getting through this morning, but you're going to pick us up. What's up, brother?
Well, Sam, you know, don't get too prone to the East Coast bias while you're here. It's really prevalent. It invades the mind. It's really tough.
Before you know it, I'm going to go back in time, and I wrote about this the other day. I'm going to finally regret my 2015 Finals MVP vote, and I'm going to think LeBron should have won it if I hang out on the East Coast long enough. That's been thing this week.
Well, you're really going to walk out of your hotel at like 7 p.m. thinking, how am I going to a game right now? How is it still 2 hours and 20 minutes from tip off? That's what's going to happen. You're going to be sitting there writing, thinking, oh, great, I finished my story. It's 3 in the morning? That's really what you're going to do.
Oh, no, buddy. I'm smarter than that. I'm becoming the off day guy. That's what I'm doing. Yeah, these 9 p.m. tips are tough. All right. So this week on the Tampering Pod, we are, of course, talking NBA Finals. Celtics Warriors split at 1. Warriors come roaring back in Game 2. We're going to get into that. Fred, I'm not going to lie. I it's funny. I actually just listened to Zach Lowe's podcast, as always, very good. And I chuckled because I've known Zach a long time. I used to work with him at SI, and we are without question wired a bit differently when it comes to the game. And I enjoy talking about all aspects of it. But near the end of his pod, he makes a comment to Jeff Van Gundy, who brought up the Draymond Green subplot of this series. And Zach was lamenting like that the Draymond conversation will take away from the tactical X's and O's conversation that he wants to have. And I'm just sitting there thinking, I don't know, man. I love me talking some Draymond. Like this vibe they had in Game 2, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart, Jason Tatum, trying to figure out how to deal with the force of Draymond, the personality of Draymond, and that officiating crew trying to figure that out. I think that's something that we will get into later in the show. But we have league goings on as well, Fred. The coaching carousel continues. Darvin Ham officially with the Lakers now, a very interesting press conference talking about the future of that team that was underwhelming, to say the least, last year. Quinn Snyder of the Utah Jazz, pardon me, steps down. I mean, somewhat as expected. We'd reported on this a lot, but big news out in Utah. And then the Charlotte coaching search continues. Kenny Atkinson looked to be the front runner, and looks like Mike D'Antoni has also joined the party when it comes to the ownership level interview stage of the process. So lots to get into, but let's talk about front and center these finals. What sort of observations do you have as we now at least know that we're going to have a bit of a series?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the Warriors defense in Game 2 was different levels than it was in Game 1. And ultimately, I think we've talked so much on this podcast. So many people have talked about elsewhere, written about elsewhere, how special the Celtics defense is. And they're not wrong. I mean, this is the best defense in the NBA in a long time. But man, the Warriors, when they're going well, like this was the number two ranked defense behind Boston during the regular season in points allowed per possession. And when they're going well, they can really cut you off. I mean, you know, Slater, who I think is jumping in here a little late shortly, but Slater.
Yes, and I left our guy out. He's coming.
Yes. And he and his story after game two, I thought made a great observation that it really started the first play of the game, where in game one, the Warriors were saying, you know what, Al Horford, take your threes. Guarding him similarly to how, and you know, Horford has shot really well in the playoffs, but part of that is because teams have guarded him in a, you know what, take your threes sort of manner. Like that's how Milwaukee guards big men, right? Like you go seven games against Milwaukee and Milwaukee's like, we're going to cut off corner threes, but you can take your ones from the wing. We're going to take away shots at the paint and that's how we're going to defend. You know, I think Golden State took a little riff on that sort of philosophy in game one. And Slater points out, you know, first possession of the game, Al Horford gets the ball at the top of the key and Draymond gets right into him. And it's just a tie up and they're on the floor. And that sort of set a tone for how they were going to guard Horford. And then they move Draymond over to Jaylen Brown on the next possession. Where he is really, really good to being able to get him into the action. So I just think Golden State's right from the tip, you know, even though it was a close game and they really didn't run away till the third quarter. And there's obviously all the Steph stuff to talk about. I just thought defensively, it's schematically defensively and execution-wise defensively, I just thought they were excellent in game two. And that really was the grand separator in my mind.
All very good observations. I think our guy, Mr. Slater, is part of the program now. Slater, you there, brother?
I am here. How are you,
Slater,
guys?
coming in hot from a red eye. Am I correct?
You are correct.
Nice. So this is the part where I stop complaining about whatever, you know, playoff fatigue, travel issues I have. Your red eye action, that is just next level hardcore. How are we feeling?
I'm fine. I actually like the red eye. Although, you know, these are the hours that I don't love the red eye, but generally I like the strategy of the red eye.
I just want to point out that as Slater talks about how he likes the red eye, we do this over Zoom and we all have our videos on and we're always talking so we can have a nice personal dynamic, how we do it every week. And Slater comes in, it's currently 10:06 a.m. At 10:04 a.m., Slater comes into the Zoom and messages, I'm staying off the Zoom if that's cool. And Sam responds, that bad, huh? So, yeah, you know, maybe take the red eye endorsement with a grain of salt.
Video being that's on the video? Yeah. It's a dark hotel room, but you know, wow. Is what it is.
So much mystery. The hell's happening there?
So what we are talking about the Warriors defense in game two. I am really surprised that they had Draymond on Horford in the first place. It's very, very weird to me. And there were several people that were a little bit confused by their original game plan because guess game what they one. Did in the yeah. Dallas series? He's on Jalen Brunson right away, game one. They have a good defensive game. I don't know why he guarded Horford. I thought that made had them susceptible to Al Horford shooting threes. He's historically, Draymond, like not been good on stretch fives because he roams off them. I mean, Nikola Mirotic is a name I can remember in the past that they never liked him guarding because, you know, he always is obsessed with getting it, you know, doing stuff. Not just standing on a big over there to make sure he doesn't shoot a three. So I was just surprised he was guarding Horford. That was all.
Well, and within all that, you've got the gamesmanship aspect that always comes with Draymond. But this one, guys, man, it's got me thinking back to whichever year it's escaping me with, you know, the infamous Draymond on the ground, LeBron stepping over him, getting 16. Ejected. It's 2016. Yeah, went 73-win year. And it feels like, you know, that aspect of the series, Draymond pushing his intensity up to the edge and then, you know, sparking a discussion after game two about did the refs, you know, kind of do him a solid by not giving him a tech when he got mixed up with Jaylen Brown. And then Steve Javi on the telecast openly talking about how, you know, that you have to think about the fact that a guy has a tech previously and is it worth ejecting him. And I think for me, going into game three, it's just, man, 6 degrees of Draymond. How are the refs going to handle him? How are the Celtics going to handle him? You know, he is, if I had to pick kind of an X factor slash MVP of this series for the Warriors, he's the guy. Steph is the engine, and Steph has been really good so far. But they're not beating the Celtics without Draymond. And I think, to go a little more macro, when the discussion about the Celtics comes up about their defense, which is incredible, I do feel like, and Fred, you joked about the East Coast bias, some of our East Coast media brethren, when they talk about Boston's D, it's as if the Warriors are just, you know, 10 slots below in the league. And while the Warriors have more vulnerabilities defensively, the Celtics do not have anybody like Draymond Green. They just don't. He's one of one. And, you know, like we know, if he wasn't hurt this year, he'd probably be, you know, defensive player yet again, player of the year. And I think that factor in this series is just massive.
He needs that attitude too. I mean, especially at this stage. I mean, we all, look, the one thing about Draymond Green is when Draymond Green is not revved up, he's not good. I mean, that's why, remember the 15 and 50 season? He couldn't get up for that season because, you know, Steph and Clay are obviously out. They're not winning. The games don't matter. And it was like he couldn't, because he's not like a traditional star. He's not like, all right, it's fine, we're losing, but like, let me get my 22, you know, get my numbers, and it's fine. He doesn't get numbers, right? I mean, he can get some assists if he's got some scores out there with him, but he needs to charge the game up and, you know, have that, you know, kind of just like winning adrenaline flowing through his veins. And, you know, it's weird because he was bordering on getting ejected, and Zach Zarba, or what, you know, any ref, it happened to be Zarba the other night, could have theoretically just said double T on Brown, Green, Draymond, you're gone. And they would, you know, he probably would have ran around the arena and been unhappy post game, but the NBA would have upheld that decision. But at the same time, I know the Warriors aren't sitting there post game saying, hey, all right, Draymond, you know, you can't do that. They need to let him act like that, basically. And if he borders on the edge and goes over the edge, Kevon Looney, your minutes are going up, basically, because Draymond's not playing in the second half. But that is the Draymond Green they need to win.
I think Draymond has clearly figured out the loophole. Like, once he get a ticky-tack tech right away, and then you can do whatever you want, because unless you punch somebody in the face, they're not ejecting
Listen,
you.
Listen, man.
So just get a tech when it doesn't matter.
I wouldn't
matter.
Put it past him. I know you're kind of kidding, Fred. I would not.
I'm not kidding at all.
No,
I'm totally serious.
By the way, yeah, he didn't figure this. He didn't figure this loophole out this season. I've talked to him about this exact, not necessarily strategy, but like he definitely does know. I mean, this year, like, years ago, I've talked to him about, like, once he gets the first tech, like, all right, referee, you know, like, you know, how far are you willing to go, basically? You know, and like, it's, that's in the regular season, that's a more reasonable, like, it's a lot riskier in the playoffs to do that. But, you know, he knows, and he said it before several times in interviews, like, referees are human. Like, you're dealing with humans out there. You're not just dealing with, like, you know, rule books.
I mean, for sure. My understanding, yeah, I know there was a lot of fans that were upset that Javi just was so open and direct about the idea that the first tech would be taken into consideration, that it should just be by the book rules, you know, in a vacuum. Is this a tech? Is it not a tech? And then if he just so happens to be ejected, so be it. Now, the irony of that is if you go back to 2016, you know, the call that was made at that point didn't suspend Draymond on its own. It was the cumulative effect of the flagrants in the playoffs. And so he did get caught up in just the rule book. The Celtics, though, and I know I might be overreacting, they just, to me, they do seem somewhat shook by Draymond. And like, when, you know, I might end up writing about this a little bit today. When Ime Udoka gets his tech, I kind of looked into that moment and asked a few questions about it from folks who were close enough to see what was going on. And like, was asked, all right, what was he fired up about? Draymond. Everything was Draymond. Ime's getting texts because of Draymond. You know, guys are trying to figure out what they're doing on the Celtics side because of Draymond. And, you know, that part, just the psychological warfare, I think is wildly fascinating.
You see what he was yelling at Grant Williams? Did you guys hear that?
No, tell me. No.
He was at the line, and you know how, like, you know, it was almost similar to the Paul Pierce one where you could hear him yelling from the mic under the rim. But he was yelling at Grant Williams, "You're not me. Stop trying to be me. You're not me."
I'm always a little scared to be the lip reader, but I will, I guess, to that point, I went back and looked at the tape of the Udoka tech, and I might have to send it to you guys. It seems pretty clear. Draymond rolls over towards Ime, says something to him. I felt like I heard something along the lines of, like, "You coming at me?" Or it was something between the two of them. Ime, as Draymond's walking away, like, pulls his mask down a little bit, and he had a word for him. It sure looked like it started with a B. And, you know, I think it's edgy as hell out there, and I'm here for it.
Yeah, and guess what? That's about to be in front of the Boston crowd. And right. Let me tell you something about Draymond Green. He doesn't necessarily back down to road crowds, as you know, Sam Amick. And you can reference the Cleveland Cavalier, you know, the 2016. Man, him and that Cleveland crowd used to just love each other. Remember when they used to, like, chant basically back and forth with each other? So it should get even more interesting as the series shifts to hostile environment for Draymond.
Although, of course, the new level that was not part of the 2016 experience is, it's still surreal to me that you have a massive game two of the finals, so much to talk about. You know, Warriors, of course, because they win, Draymond's in a better mood. I saw him post-game. He was, you know, going to visit, do little meet and greets with fans, and he was in a good place. And then, lo and behold, of course, he goes home and podcasts, and he's, you know, giving you his perspective right out the gate, just being like one of us, one of the media members. But let's go spend it ahead to game three.
That's what I think when I hear Draymond Green. He's just like us.
Just like
that's
us.
That's what I hear.
He's also staying at the Boston Courtyard Marriott at the airport. game three, the Boston crowd. I am excited to be here. I might lament some of the travel logistics, but I'm excited to be here. It's been a few years. I think 2019, last time I was here. I might have said last week on the pod, you know, my first finals ever was Lakers Celtics in 2010, and that was certainly a memorable one. So I'm, you know, looking forward to the Garden environment, just the Boston experience in general, the history that comes with this franchise, and then obviously the Warriors trying to keep making some of their own. What where are you guys' heads at in terms of game three?
I think Boston, it's going to be really interesting to see how Boston attacks the way that Golden State defended in that game. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they guard Curry after he's kind of had a major blow up in game one in the first quarter, and then a major blow up in the third quarter. And I think that's ultimately going to be the difference. There's also the turnovers, which we haven't discussed. I mean, the way that they were able to get into passing lanes and the way that the Warriors were able to force turnovers when Gary Payton II was on the floor after he didn't really get any time in game one was a really big thing too. I mean, Boston will turn it over, and that's kind of their heel, because when they're turning it over, not only are they giving away offensive possessions, they can't get into their set defense, which is when they are really, really able to turn the tables on the other side, right? That's when they're able to get stops and they're able to get turnovers and get running, which initiates their offense. So when they're turning it over, which they will do, like Jaylen Brown was turning it over and can get sloppy and can lose his handle. And Tatum, the thing with Tatum's passing, which is really interesting, is he'll have these great passing games. In certain moments, you know, that 13 assist game he had recently, his passes tend to come off of, okay, the defender helped from here, so I know that my guy is cutting in this direction. And he's become really, really excellent at reads. But when the Warriors throw different quirks, when the Warriors are going to help in a little bit of an unconventional way, or the guy is going to help from the corner, is going to go to a little bit of a different place than he normally would, I think that's when you see Tatum still get a little bit thrown off on those reads. So it's going to be Slater. How do you think those guys just respond to kind of those just sort of those mishaps with the ball that they had in game two?
I'll say one thing. I think the whistle is going to matter in game three, you know, how tight it's called.
Oh, that too.
You know, they're not point guards. You know, Jaylen Brown, the Warriors just play Luka. And every time they made like different rotation or one guy would rotate late, it just felt like Luka saw it. And Luka, suddenly the guy was jumping late down to cut off the, you know, Reggie Bullock in the corner, we'll say. And suddenly Luka was angling his pass like right at the last second different to suddenly go up to the wing. And it's Finney Smith on the wing and he hits him perfectly. Like Luka was just pinpoint and just reading everything. And as good as Tatum is, and, you know, you could say 13 assists in game one. Go look at the assists. I mean, they're one extra pass away. The Warriors made it really simple. They didn't defend well. I just think with Brown and Tatum, and even Smart to a degree, although he's a little bit more of a point guard, they're just not naturally, like, you know, elite playmakers. They can draw attention. They can make the extra pass. They've certainly, part of Boston's rise this season has been their increased willingness to move the ball. So, you know, I'd probably pick Boston to win game three, but I think generally that level of Warriors defense, particularly when they're allowed to get handsy, is going to cause trouble for when they're playing that revved up. It's going to cause trouble for, I think, a group of Boston playmakers who just aren't that great at playmaking.
You know,
there's Slater, there's the other side of this. Oh, sorry, Sam. Go ahead. I was going to say there's just the other side of this too, which is like, some guys for Boston just had flat out bad games in game two that aren't necessarily going to continue. I mean, Al Horford couldn't get a shot off for the most part. Marcus Smart was one of those guys who was, I think he had five turnovers in the game and was giving the ball away, and he shot 1 for 6 from the field. I mean, Boston shot really, really, really terribly inside the 3-point arc. And we've talked about on the podcast before with guys like, you know, especially with Tatum, how he will take difficult off the dribble shots. You know, Jaylen Brown too will take some tough off the dribble shots, and Jaylen Brown shot 5 of 17 in that game. But here's the thing: they often make them. They will have times where they just go off on them, and those guys were just not what you expect from them inside the inside the 3-point arc, and I think that is something that will naturally just look better in game three, because we did not see an impressive showing from them in that sense. I think they were 15 for 43 from 2-point range in that game. It's just not what you expect out of them.
Guys, before we get into some of the other league business, you got me thinking, Slater, with some of the commentary on the Celtics. Who comes to mind for you guys historically in terms of teams with two wildly talented wings like Brown and Tatum, who have playmaking abilities, but they are not natural playmakers, not point guards. And this like years long challenge of the Celtics trying to figure out, are we doing Kyrie? Are we doing Kemba? Are we going to now go back to Marcus? You know, you don't want a conventional point guard because, you know, these guys need the ball. You know, I think about LeBron and D Wade, but LeBron, you know, is a point guard. He can't be.
You know, pinpoint. LeBron sees the court at an absurd level. I don't know. I mean, doppelganger wise, I'm a little on the spot here. I don't know about you, Fred. I mean, can you think of?
I mean, what about the Paul George, Kawhi Leonard Clippers? How they've been in search for a point guard all this time?
Very much so.
You know,
that's actually
those guys
spot on.
Yeah, I mean, those guys are, you know, they're as good as it comes when it comes to two-way wings. I mean, that's for sure the best two-way wing combination.
And they both, that's a great one. I mean, then you could have an interesting debate about, you know, between the two combos, you know, which playmaking level is higher, you know what I mean? But they both have playmaking skills. They just, that challenge to find the perfect fit in the puzzle piece component of you know, these really, really good elite teams with these stars that are trying to just get over that final edge to become a championship team. This, you know, that aspect of this Celtics team is everything. Is they get tripped up in game two by some of those dynamics, and they get, you know, that's part of the turnover prone problem that they have, is this imperfect fit that they've had for so long now.
I'll give you another one. How about the Toronto Raptors that faced the Warriors in 2019 finals? It's not a perfect similarity because those Raptors had, you know, Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet running point. But I just, Siakam and Kawhi were like kind of the two points of attack, I think, coming at the Warriors offensively. They had this veteran defense. You know, we could almost make the comparisons of, like, you know, Marc Gasol to Al Horford, Serge Ibaka to Rob Williams, you know, Lowry to Marcus Smart, and then, you know, the two wings I mentioned. That was a little bit similar, but, you know, that's part of the reason why I think, you know, what Van Vliet and Lowry did to the Warriors in that series to you know, bump Toronto over the top, I think is just like what Marcus Smart needs to do. Marcus Smart had a really good game one, not a great game two. If you had me pick a barometer, I should say, for this series, it's probably Marcus Smart's play. If I just one player, you just told me his stat line after the game, I bet I could probably pick who won the game.
Right, right. Celtics, by the way, based off of what I was just saying, Celtics shot 11 of 37 on two pointers that weren't in the restricted area. That's a lot of shots of two pointers that aren't in the restricted area and a lot of misses. It's shot 29%.
Tatum is like 7 of 24 or something on twos in this series. But sometimes we've talked about it on this podcast, sometimes I feel like he bails the Warriors out a little bit. Suddenly, like, Jordan Poole's on him on a switch, and he's, like, 19 feet out. Instead of, like, really going at Jordan Poole, he's like, let me just take this little, like, fadeaway over the top of him. And it's like, you might make it. You might not. I mean,
with Gary Payton the second, too, there's some of that where you got a foot on the guy, and, you know, and you're playing with the ball, and just rise up.
Yeah, I mean, because if you're going to dribble it near Gary Payton, that's dangerous.
Right.
Another factor. I mean, I know – we kind of skimmed over it, but, like, you know, he changed game two. I thought he changes what the Warriors can be, the lineups they can use. And we were so unsure of his status really going into game two. It's like, okay, they're going to try him. He played 25 minutes, I think he did. I mean, he looks like, to me, very much healthy enough to play 28 or so minutes per game, which that is huge. I mean, and he does.
Yeah,
to
I mean, me, he looked brought like, force.
He looked like Gary Payton the second. He fell on the elbow, didn't care. He took the corner three when he needed to, and he's flying around with, like, kind of reckless abandon with that elbow. Didn't even wear an elbow brace or anything. So I thought that was obviously a very good sign for the Warriors.
The defensive personnel in this series is outrageous. It's absurd. I mean, Draymond is, in my opinion, the best defender in the league. Marcus Smart is the defensive player of the year. Gary Payton the second, if he played enough minutes, would be a first team all defense guy every year. I mean, the defensive personnel, I mean, there are the millions of guys on the Celtics, the defensive personnel and just the general defensive. Looney is so good defensively. Wiggins has become so good defensively. So the defensive talent in this series is.
Well, and you're seeing, and I know, you know, Jordan Poole ended up having some good second half moments, but I mean, Jordan for long stretches looking like he can't play in this series. It's an incredibly high level defensive series where you can't have any of those weak spots. I think that's where Gary Payton II and his return is massive, because the Celtics, you know, if you're talking across the board, they are deeper defensively, in my opinion. They don't have the Jordan Pools out there. I mean, Payton Pritchard a little bit, but that's, you know, that's kind of a slight to Payton to even put him in the same sentence. So the defense is fun to watch. Let's jump into some of the other stuff here on the other side of the break, guys. We've been talking finals a lot. I think it's time to talk Lakers after this ad break. They introduce Darvin Ham, the former Bucks assistant, former Lakers assistant, had a lot of things to say. And you know, we always love talking Lake Show. So we will be right back. All right, guys, taking the program over to Lakerland. Darvin Ham comes in. Nice suit. I think he had a suit on. Sitting next to Rob Pelinka doing his press conference. You got the local media contingent doing their thing. And our Bill Oram, Lakers beat writer, longtime Lakers beat writer, gets the mic and asks Darvin Ham a question about the LeBron James, Anthony Davis, Russell Westbrook trio. And I'm paraphrasing, but essentially just whether or not Darvin, you know, sees light at the end of that tunnel or sees hope where there wasn't much last season. And, you know, we talked off air a little bit, Slater, before you joined us, about just takeaways from that presser. And certainly at the top of that list for me, was we'd been reporting for months that Russell Westbrook was appearing to still be part of the Lakers program, that they did not intend to really, I mean, they're always going to be open to trading him, but they're not giving anything up to dump him, and they wanted to make it work, and they wanted a coach who had a vision in which he thought he could make it work. This was the first time that we learned more about Darvin Ham's actual vision, because his answer to Bill's question was all about defense, talking about how this is a guy that I need to defend like he used to, defend at a high level. He's talking about running lanes on the offensive end. It was a pretty specific, you know, kind of marching orders, if you will, in Russ's direction. And I believe Russ was standing in the back of the room kind of taking it all in.
Yeah, I'd almost say two things. Number one, you don't have to say you think. The Sportsnet, I think it was, cameras panned to Russell Westbrook. It was like lasered in on the press conference. Did you guys see that video? He was just like watching.
I did. Very
interesting. Yeah. Number one, like, you know,
Russell Westbrook understanding the importance of beat reporters asking relevant questions. How about that?
Like Draymond, he's one of us.
I mean, just, you know, I mean, along the lines of like Russell Westbrook still in their plans. I mean, he's at the facility listening to the head coach's press conference. I mean, that's notable. And then number two, and I look,
wouldn't that be great if you just chimed in from the back? Like, ain't that some bullshit?
Yeah.
What are you talking about, coach?
Darvin, do you think Russell Westbrook should lead the team in shots next season? No, I would love to rope Fred in on this one. And like, I could, like, Darvin Ham's messaging I thought was very good. Especially, look, Russell Westbrook's not only is Russell Westbrook probably listening somewhere out in the world, he's literally listening to you. So, like, you need to say the right thing. So, I don't blame Darvin Ham for saying anything he did. But, you know, objective observer here, when has Russell Westbrook been some unbelievable defensive point guard? I mean, in college, like, he has tools to be, he has defensive possessions where he will strip you or jump a passing lane and throw down a dunk. And, you know, if I just showed you his highlight tape, you'd be like, that's all defense first team. But me and Fred have, you know, covered him on the daily in Oklahoma City. You know, he falls asleep. He you know, doesn't box out at times. He's not a lot of times as committed to the game plan as he should be. And this is not be a one season thing in LA. He never has been. So it's not on Darvin Ham to get him back to who he used to be. It's on Darvin Ham to, you know, discover a consistent game plan, discipline, Russell Westbrook, who's never really existed in the NBA, at least.
Yeah, Russell Westbrook is the kind of gambler on defense who successfully gambles just barely enough to justify to himself that he should always gamble. And that's kind of how I classify Russ as a defender, where he'll trail a guy behind a pick and roll when he could stay in front of him on the pick and roll and just thwart him and make the guy run another action. Instead, he'll trail behind him on the pick and roll and try to poke the ball out. And about once every game or two, he'll poke the ball out. And that justifies being able to do things like that. But all the other plays, a guy gets a steam, you know, gets his momentum downhill and is able to go to the basket and make a play for himself or a teammate. And yeah, I mean, look, it's been 15 years of Russ playing the way that he plays, and it worked extremely well for him for basically 13 and a half of those years. I just don't expect him to change the style of play that he has played throughout his entire career. I mean, we've seen him with four teams, four different coaches. He was under Billy Donovan in with the Thunder, and then the next year he's under Mike D'Antoni in Houston, and the next year he's under Scott Brooks in Washington, and the next year he's under Frank Vogel in with the Lakers, and it's different locations, it's different coaches, it's different players, and you kind of get stylistically the same version of Russ for the most part. There was a time where he was kind of playing a different sort of style in Houston, but it took Houston literally trading away a legitimately good starting center to conform to his sorts of weaknesses to push him into that style, right? And it took maybe the greatest offensive head coach of his entire generation in order to create that sort of environment for Russ to be able to have his most efficient scoring season that he's had in a long time. So I don't anticipate the Russell Westbrook defense to ramp up, but like, there's nothing that Darvin Ham said that was wrong. I mean, he wants Russell Westbrook to play better defense. Like, well, and yeah. And
guess what that means, Fred? That means that when Russ doesn't play better defense, you have already preemptively explained to the world why he's not getting the kind of time that he typically would get. I mean, that's the other thing. Darvin is being smart here and setting the ground rules and creating the vision. And, you know, with that comes the idea that, you know, if you're not capable or willing of you know, executing the game plan, then we're going to find another way to do it.
Yes, Fred, yeah. I would say the only thing I was disagreeing with Darvin Ham on, and again, I have no problem with, obviously he should say it, but like, we're going to get him back to, he was saying like, we're going to get him back to what he used to be defensively. I'm like, nah, it's a tougher task than that, Darvin. You can't say, hey, let's you know, mold you back in a 2016 version of you on the defensive end, because, you know, offensively.
Well, it's also a way, I mean, there's like shades of passive aggressiveness there too, where it's a way to, you know, respectfully announce that we don't want the ball, like the focus is not the ball being in your hands. You know, we're going to use you offensively in the kind of way where you can't be usurping anything from LeBron and AD like you did last year, you know, when his usage was still pretty high. So, you know, that's the other aspect here, is it is setting ground rules on both ends of the floor for how Darvin wants to use him.
So I think it was a week or two ago, we were on the podcast, we were talking about Darvin Ham before his hire became official. And yep. I mentioned a piece that I wrote last year when he was a finalist for the Wizards job and I was covering the Wizards. I spoke to another assistant coach who has worked with Darvin intimately before and kind of got like, what is the Darvin Ham scouting report? How do you describe him as a coach? And I was asked, I one of the questions that I asked was, what do you think his strategy would be like as a coach? And he said he thinks he'd be the kind of coach who basically can not a system coach, a guy who creates a system based on the roster he has and then uses that. But he also said, and this is what this assistant coach who has worked with Darvin Ham intimately says, said about Darvin. He interjected in the middle of this, but he believes in ball movement. I know that. He talks about that often with the players. It's more like Budenholzer is telling players to play with the pass, share the ball, and then Darvin will come in and look at you in that deep voice like, hey, man, he's open, pass him the ball, and everyone listens. So I would say offensively, it's playing together and sharing the ball. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Darvin Ham tries to implement that into an offense that has Anthony Davis, Russell Westbrook, and LeBron James, because as we all know, ball movement was not a big thing in Los Angeles last year. And look, sometimes ball movement is a little bit overrated. Like when you have Luka Doncic, you should give Luka Doncic the ball. That's a good thing. You don't need to lead the league in passes per game when you have Luka Doncic. But there's good organic ball movement that can be had that's not necessarily based on number of passes. And the Lakers were lacking in that last year. And Russell Westbrook teams tend to lack in that.
James teams also, you know, I mean, like he's still the one captaining the offense.
But LeBron is, I put in the Luka category. It's like you put your basketball ethics to the side when the greatness exceeds the morals, you know, and as it does with LeBron. Like with Russ, I'm not sure where the Lakers finished for sure last year, but heading into last year, you know, the Second Spectrum started tracking passes per game in like 2013. And heading into last year, so like an 8 or 9 year sample, no Russell Westbrook team had ever finished above 27th in the league in passes per game. Like it's just you're not going to get a ball movement team if you are using him as a featured player. So it's that's a projection. That's a projection from someone who knows him, but I'm interested to see what Darvin Ham does with that.
Guess what the issue is?
Yes, it is what the issue is.
You know,
what's the issue?
If he's not a featured player, is he a spot up shooter? I mean,
right.
Is he the guy in the corner you're kicking it out to who's like jacking it? Because that ain't good. You know, that's kind of been the fit issue from the day they traded him. And I'm
running
not sure.
Lanes, like, running
you know
lanes,
who's
running
a great
lanes.
Coach? Frank Vogel's a great coach. Does anybody believe coaching was the problem last year? That's like, you know, I think Darvin Ham's a good hire. I just like, to me, the issue has issues, roster issues have not been solved. And maybe they can correct some with some, you know, their surrounding pieces last season beyond Russell Westbrook weren't good. But maybe the Rasheed Wallace hiring helps too. Did you guys see that one?
We did indeed. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't think you need to put, look, ideally, in a world where Russ conforms to the fact that he's entering year 15 and is willing to change his game and has this grand realization over the offseason, like, okay, I'm going to fit in better and still be really good. I don't think you need to say like, okay, he's either on the ball all the time or off the ball all the time, and he's an off-ball shooter who can't shoot threes. Like, I don't think it needs to be that. Like, there are various ways you can splice in a guy like him and use his skill set. Like, he still sees passes that very few other people see. He plays at his own pace and he makes, you know, these wild decisions at times, but he still sees passes that other people don't see.
But almost, you know, aren't all of those passes usually like he is creating the offensive situation to, you know, he's the one breaking somebody off the dribble. And then, yes, he makes a nice pass, but it's like, to me, the problem is like he needs to be the guy from the corner who makes a sweet back cut, you know, he's in the dunker spot, you know, he's playing a Gary, he has the athleticism essentially to be kind of like Gary Payton the second, right?
Yeah, I was gonna say like
play like Gary
Bruce Payton, Brown so. But way better.
Yeah,
but
he just never done it, and it suddenly then we're gonna be having the same conversation preseason that we had last year, that we've had every year of his career almost, you know, for the last 10, which is like, you know, if he figures out how to move off the ball a little bit better, if he cuts, he could be one of the best cutters in the league. I've heard several people say that, and it's like, yes, he could, but he's like, to me, that ship has sailed. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's my only point is I'm delineating between it being an issue. Like, I don't think it's an issue of deteriorating skill set. It's only an issue of deteriorating skill set because he won't change his style. Or hasn't changed his style. And I agree with you that the chances of him changing his style are pretty damn unlikely because he's never done it and he's never shown any signs of doing it. But it's not like there isn't nothing there. Like, I understand why Darvin Ham would come out and say that, and he has to support his guy too. He's not just going to come out and be like, oh, I can't work with this. There's nothing. But I think it's just like a little more nuance. It's a guy who has stuff that he can give. It's just his, for whatever reason, he hasn't shown the willingness to change.
All right, gents, you guys could do a 4-hour pod on Russ. I'm convinced, and I love hearing it, but let's jump to the other coaching action. This week on the other side of this ad, we're going to talk Quinn Snyder stepping down in Utah and the Charlotte coaching search. We'll be right back.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
All right, gentlemen, I'm going to take it over to Utah. Fred, I think you have a few thoughts on Charlotte, and we'll get to that in a second. But Quinn Snyder, pretty unique coaching situation that unfolded here. You know, you got a guy who was there 8 seasons, did a lot of good things, had a lot of playoff heartaches, was very popular in the locker room, widely respected around the league, is a very good coach. And then, you know, throughout the course of this past season, you started to hear that there was something happening with Quinn and just the question about his future. And he had, you know, time left on his contract, so it wasn't a contractual situation, even though later on the Jazz did offer him an extension that he declined. But it was just this, like, cumulative effect of, I think, you know, a group that had a lot of promise that wasn't getting to the promised land like they'd hoped. And I think the fatigue that came with that and the fact that Quinn, you know, it just in terms of his personality is your quintessential, no pun intended, just, you know, burning the midnight oil every single night, game planning. You know, I remember hearing a story late in the season about how they were grinding, trying to find their way. And I think they played at the Warriors, and then they had a practice the next day. I'm sorry, an off day, then a practice. And it was like he spent 10 hours, you know, game planning for that practice because they practiced so infrequently that he wanted it to be absolutely perfect to just get whatever he could out of this group. So then you fast forward to this week, he finally makes that choice that we thought was coming for quite some time, and he steps down. And there's a lot of layers here. You know, some of the stuff that I do think came into play, there's been a lot of change in Utah last couple of years. You know, Ryan Smith comes in as the owner. It goes from kind of a very small operation in terms of the ownership component before with the Miller family to now. This is a you know, very wealthy, very young, very, very energetic tech guy coming in to run the Jazz. You know, he's bringing Danny Ainge in to lead the front office. Dennis Lindsay is out. Dwayne Wade is part of the program. He's, you know, occasionally coaching up Donovan Mitchell on the sideline. He's on TNT talking about the Jazz, which is a little weird. So a lot there. I do think, though, if you ask me, you know, number one reason that Quinn stepped down, I think it was, you know, just burned out in this environment. I think there was family stuff. I'm curious to see, you know, if he ends up coaching next season. It seems unlikely just given the fact that right now it's just Charlotte with the opening. But what'd you guys think of the Quinn news?
Wasn't surprised. I mean, we've been hearing noise about this for a really long time. Utah media has been reporting on it for a long time. Just the possibility that he could end up leaving on his own volition. And, no, not surprised about it. I mean, it sounds Utah, they have an imperfect situation. And, you know, sometimes stuff just, after a while, sometimes stuff can just get a little bit stale. Like, sometimes it happens. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it sounds like they have a pretty good list. You hear really good things about, I mean, Shams reported a number of the candidates that they're looking at, and you hear really good things about them. You know, Johnny Bryant is one of those guys. I cover Johnny. He's an assistant with the Knicks, and he was in Utah for 6 years and has a really close relationship with Donovan Mitchell. And he's somebody who you have to consider a very legit candidate there. And Alex Jensen, who has been in Utah for a while and I guess has a chance to get elevated. You know, Will Hardy is another guy who Shams put on that list, you know, lead assistant in Boston who, you know, I know the Spurs loved him. He's somebody who, like, if Pop retired, Will Hardy is somebody who I would think would be right there in the discussion to take over in San Antonio, along with maybe Quinn Snyder. But, you know, obviously we don't know anything about that right now. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how that team responds to a new voice and a new head coach, because they've lauded their continuity for so many years, not just on the roster, but also in the coaching staff, just having those same guys. And this is kind of, you know, over the last couple of years in terms of management, bringing in Danny Ainge and, you know, Dennis Lindsay and now Quinn Snyder leaving. It's just the continuity in management is not necessarily there anymore.
Yeah. I'd say from the Utah perspective, I'm just curious how this changes or doesn't change what they do with the roster this summer. You know, obviously Gobert's future, Donovan Mitchell's future. And then from the Quinn Snyder standpoint, I would expect a season off. You know, you wonder about him in the future as like potentially San Antonio, Greg Popovich's successor. That's always been, I don't want to say rumor, but at least rumblings that he would be of the potential. Sure. Yeah. And you know, that how long do we think that is? Maybe, I mean, Popovich has not, I feel like Greg Popovich is the kind of guy where one Thursday we're just going to wake up and be like, Greg Popovich retired this morning? That's right. So it could be.
I think the Spurs people might even have the same reaction to that. Then be like, I don't think anyone's any more in on it than us.
How would we feel, this kind of segues to our last topic, how would we feel about Frank Vogel in Utah? I had somebody hit me up and I think that's a possibility, and I think you got a few ties there with Danny Ainge and his time in Boston with Frank, which was kind of on the front end of Frank's career back in the days of the video room and kind of making his way through the NBA ranks. What do you think that guy's, or what do you think that would look like?
I think that he'd want to, if he took the job, probably have some more assurances that they're going to, you know, build out the perimeter defense a bit better. I mean, obviously Frank Vogel and Rudy Gobert reminds you of, you know, Frank Vogel and Roy Hibbert. Remember when Roy Hibbert had that like one or two season run where he was, he was, you know,
really good
verticality. He like created the verticality. You know, it's intriguing because the idea of having, you know, if you were to maintain Rudy Gobert, keep him on the roster, is like build a really good defense. But you need, as has been shown the last few seasons, you need like perimeter guys around Rudy Gobert that can guard, and Utah hasn't had them. So, Frank Vogel was a good coach, so I think that would theoretically be a good hire, but they need to build the roster well. The roster to me is the biggest like question mark, more than like who they might hire.
Good stuff. Good stuff. All right. Let's go to Charlotte, Fred. Kenny Atkinson looked to be out front and was meeting this week with Michael Jordan, the final decision maker, of course, in Charlotte. But I was admittedly a little surprised. We were waiting to see if it was just going to be Kenny getting, you know, the MJ stage, or, and then a matter of if he was going to pull off that interview and get the job, or if they were going to invite anybody else to that next level. So Mike D'Antoni is there as well, and it's an interesting debate and discussion about style, about, you know, I mean, with Mike, and I'm sure he doesn't love this aspect of it, but it's, you know, it is fair. He's been doing this a long time, and we talk about Greg Popovich and his ability to keep connecting, keep developing, keep impacting young players. You know, Mike, I think, has been impactful all the way through in his head coaching career until he resigned in Houston. But you know, inevitably now that's going to be part of the conversation with Charlotte. Is that a better fit? You know, Mike D'Antoni trying to do his point guard magic with LaMelo Ball, and you go that route, or, you know, a guy in Kenny Atkinson who did some good developmental work in Brooklyn. What do you guys think there?
It is interesting because, like, Atkinson during his time, the thing about Atkinson is I don't even think you can look at him as a coach who got fired, because he didn't get fired for really reasons that anybody deemed to be related to his job performance. You know, it's like the final straw was him not wanting to start DeAndre Jordan over Jared Allen. I think that decision has aged quite well. Right. So, I mean, I think you look at Kenny Atkinson and the way that his Brooklyn teams just constantly played, just kind of outperformed expectations, how hard they played, how together they played, the ball movement on those teams, the way that they cut, the player movement on those teams. I think that could work extremely well. I like both of these candidates. I think it's very obvious that I like both these candidates. I think Kenny Atkinson is the sum of their parts is greater than their whole sort of hire. And that was what he gave during his time in Brooklyn. And with D'Antoni, I'm just thinking, like, you know, in Houston, he turned into this guy who we're going to have tremendously efficient offenses, but we're going to play slow. We're not going to run that much. It's going to be a lot of ISO. We don't even need to use picks for James Harden. And that's how you're going to maximize James Harden. Clearly, it worked tremendously well. And I wonder if he would kind of, if the Hornets, if he got this job, would look a little bit more like his old Suns team. Because the personnel is just like, they can play fast and you can run and you can go small, and LaMelo can just run tons of pick and rolls. I just think LaMelo's, has there ever been a point guard who's played for Mike D'Antoni who has not become a better offensive point guard under Mike D'Antoni? Like, I literally can't think of one who didn't make significant improvements under Mike D'Antoni. I think he could be tremendous for LaMelo's development and really helping that guy become a star and working around just the athleticism and the amount of ball handlers they have on that team. But I don't know how different that team is going to look. You know, what if they trade Gordon Hayward? What if they bring in a rim protecting big, which they've been on the prowl for a while? They wanted a center all last year, and then they ended up trading for Montrezl Harrell, who's just like not the center that they needed. So I'm curious to see what they do this offseason too, personnel wise, because I feel like that roster could look a little different. And Bridges is a restricted free agent too.
Yeah, they got a whole line of Bridges.
I've enjoyed covering Kenny Atkinson this season because he's not your typical Warriors assistant coach, you know, and that's why they brought him in. You know, this the Warriors were looking to jolt their coaching staff with something different this offseason from a developmental perspective and from an analytics perspective. Kenny Atkinson is he speaks the analytics language. You hear that a lot around the Warriors, and like he's the guy who goes and gets the reports from the Warriors analytics department and like brings them to the coaches meetings. And not only that, but he's been like, you know, at the head of the Jonathan Kuminga developmental plan. And, you know, obviously Charlotte has young players, and, you know, historically you go back to the Brooklyn Nets days. I mean, he has a very good track record with that. And he's just personality wise, very interesting. You know, you walk in the building and he'll be after he's, you know, first of all, he's over there, like, you know, basically guarding Klay Thompson in the post. And he's like really intense. He's worked up a full sweat. He's like trying to get stops on Klay Thompson. And then Klay Thompson will be done going through that part of his shooting routine. And Kenny Atkinson will be like, all right, well, now I'm going to run wind sprint. Basically, you know, he's 50 something years old. You know, he'll go over there to the weight room and start doing like a bench press. You're like, man, this guy has like endless energy. And it's just been, I mean, you guys know kind of like the laid back vibe of the Warriors. And it's just, he has been a good shock to their system, I think, from a coaching perspective this season. And I also think he, you know, in conversations with him, he talks a lot about some of the stuff he's learned being around Steve Kerr, being around the Warriors environment, that I think both him and Mike Brown, if Kenny Atkinson does get the Charlotte job, will help them going into their next jobs. I think Kenny Atkinson is an appealing hire, but I also agree with what Fred was talking about, where Mike D'Antoni running a LaMelo Ball offense is also an interesting concept.
Yeah, you know, Fred, you mentioned like Kenny Atkinson's analytics type stuff. Like that goes back to Brooklyn. Like Spencer Dinwiddie, when he came into Brooklyn, was a journeyman who was close to being out of the league, right? And part of his development was Atkinson presenting him with numbers on like, okay, your shooting percentages are not great. Here's how we can make you an efficient player on our team. And he specifically showed him like, he showed him numbers on pick and rolls that ended up with like lobs between him and Jared Allen. All right, here are the spots where you have to get to. And Spencer Dinwiddie really bought into it. And to the point that he can just recite those numbers now. Yeah, you know, Jared Allen and I were the third most efficient lob combination in the league during our second year together in Brooklyn. And yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting coaching style, because you guys know as well as I do, a lot of players, and Dinwiddie might be an exception here, but a lot of players, if you overload them with numbers, it convolutes the conversation. Like people don't want to respond to numbers. They want to respond to concepts. He seems to have this ability to be able to explain these kind of difficult mathematical concepts in an extremely simplified way, which I think is just a sign of someone who's an excellent communicator. That's a really interesting point as well, Slater,
your energy commentary is quite humbling. As you know, Fred told the listeners earlier that we're on Zoom, and I'm sitting here rubbing my eyes and yawning as I get over the Boston travel, and you got Kenny Atkinson out here doing CrossFit after Warriors practices. So energy matters in this league. I need to get some more of it right now and go get some coffee. And with that, gentlemen, I'm going to let you go. We got some finals media day to get to out here in Boston. Slater, I will see you in a few. Fred, good stuff as always. Appreciate the listeners, and we will talk to you next week.